Omnibus is a production of iHeartRadio.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 1091.PS6503, certificate number 36841. The Rural Purge.
Welcome to Hee Haw, starring Buck Owens and Roy Clark.
You have a TV network, an American television network that's like kind of deep in your childhood blood, the primordial soup of John Roderick. Like what is the TV, American TV channel to you?
Interesting. I always felt like an NBC guy, but in the 70s, I was a CBS guy. I don't think I ever was an ABC person.
There was a brief window when, thanks to Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley and,
Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley.
Oh, Three's Company.
Three's Company. Mork and Mindy.
ABC had this big sitcom block, right. And they were, in the late 70s, they were suddenly the dominant network in America. And I was wondering if because I'm an NBC kid, I came up on the Huxtable era of Brandon Tartikoff family sitcoms.
I absolutely watched all those sitcoms, and that was our block, but like...
I wonder if NBC just having the peacock and the bung, 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 if kids tend to remember.
Well... ABC employed the theme song, or I'm sorry, the jingle for ABC in the mid-70s was Still the One, which was song by the band Orleans. We're still the one.
It's that we're still having fun and we're still having fun.
And it was such a catchy tune, and ABC played it all the time. It was like, it felt like maybe for just that summer, but it connected with me in that way that only great pop music can do when it's excerpted into a 30-second promo jingle. And I think at least at that point in that part of my life, I wouldn't even been able to tell you a different television station than ABC because I was so fixated on that tune. But then the NBC Peacock, I mean, they all were pretty good at getting kids to try and identify with it.
Right, because Saturday mornings, that's when you see all the promos if you're a kid. A catchy jingle goes a long way, like the that Motown song, Get Ready, Because Here I Come.
Yeah.
I only associate with that as a kid and hearing the new lyrics, Get Ready for Como Kids Fair, which was some kind of summer kids event run by the local ABC affiliate here. So this must have been, You're the One, that We're Still Having Fun and We're Still the One must have been that brief era when ABC was the number one.
Yeah, mid-70s, right? 77 or something like
that. Late 70s, I think.
And we would have watched all the programs that you describe. And then it started to transition into more mature fare, of course, like The Love Boat and Fantasy Island, where...
That was all ABC stuff too, right?
Yeah, it was implied that people were having sex. No one in the Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley universe. I guess Fonzie, it was suggested that Fonzie
F's.
had some sex with people, but no one else did.
With Leather Tuscadero?
Yeah.
But on The Love Boat, Jamie Farr would slink back to his cabin with who?
It was the
not Stephanie Powers. She's out of his league. Who's some?
Who would Jamie Farr? Maybe Cindy Sherman.
There we go. You know, this is not a thing that exists anymore. Of people identifying with a network, isn't that funny? I mean, I guess in the '90s it would have. In the '80s it was NBC, and then, you know, when the media landscape started to fragment, I guess you were more of a, you know, you're an ESPN guy in college.
No, you remember when Fox first showed up on the scene.
Right. Okay. So yeah, there is a Fox type because they were the edgy programming and all the college kids were watching Simpsons and X-Files.
And Married with Children.
Exactly. Yeah. This kind of stuff you wouldn't see on the three old traditional networks.
But they really did like so many things like Ford and Chevy, or like various record labels, RSO versus Universal or something, you know, a big part of the scarcity of media at the time was associating it like with a football team, sort of part of the way they sold their content, I guess, which we did. It's not what we would have said then.
We said programming. We didn't know yet that we had invented content.
That was true, I guess, with the radio stations in my town. You would describe yourself as someone who either listened to 102.5 or listened to 107.7.
And the marketing angle is the same. Don't touch that dial, right? This is where you leave it in your car. And when you're at home, you come home from work and you just leave it on where, you know, NBC or ABC or wherever your feel-good sitcoms are going to be. Because they don't want you switching around and being like, well, I switch over to Dallas, but then I come back to NBC for Carson. Like, they really want you to stick it out.
When I was a drinking man, there was the bar that I drank at.
The bar at which you drank.
The bar at drank which
when I was a prepositioning ending a sentence with, man.
They had a happy hour that was from, I think, you know, 8 to 10 or something like that. And a new bar opened down the block. Linda's was the new bar. The Comet is where I drank. Linda's opened and put their happy hour 1 hour.
I thought you were going to say 1 minute.
No, their happy hour started 1 hour later, I think. So maybe the Comet was 7 to 9 and Linda's was 8 to 10. So you'd start at the Comet, but then you'd go to Linda's for that extra hour of happy hour. But of course, that's where you'd stay the rest of the night.
It's smart. I was thinking you'd put it 10 minutes earlier, but really later is what keeps people there.
And I think she may have tried it the other way and then realized, oh, everybody leaves here to go to the Comet. So she flipped it around. Savvy.
You know, of course, once the media landscape fragmented, there were more options. And, you know, it really could reflect your personality more. Because honestly, the programming on NBC and ABC and CBS were not that different.
What were the sitcoms that went up against Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley?
Well, in the late 70s, NBC was just unwatched. NBC was a disaster.
Right, I remember that.
Before the Cosby Show kind of remodeled its as sitcom brand.
And so what did they have on?
But CBS had kind of the classier, socially relevant stuff. That's where you would watch MASH or Archie Bunker.
Okay.
The Jeffersons.
And I think that's why I associated myself as a CBS kid because of
it's
MASH.
It's classy.
Yeah.
It's kind of forgotten now that we think of, if we remember these three networks as monoliths at all, we kind of think of them as kind of interchangeable, you know, three cars constantly jockeying for the lead. In fact, that is not true. CBS was the top rated television network in America from 1955 to 1976 without interruption.
Wow.
Everybody else was
Had Walter Cronkite too.
They had Walter Cronkite. They were the, they were the Tiffany network. They were the kind of the gold standard of classy, respectable American family television. And they were just an unstoppable ratings juggernaut. In 1962, 19 of the top 25 shows on the air in terms of Nielsen ratings, were CBS shows.
Now, The Tonight Show was NBC.
Yes.
Which was always in that time slot the top-rated show, wasn't it? Didn't The Carson Show kind of have a lock at least on that nighttime?
Yes. So there were other day parts, which I think is what they say in the TV world, where, you know, somebody else could be dominant. Somebody's soaps could be better than somebody else's soaps. Maybe somebody's game shows were better. Carson was dominant. Obviously, you can't counter-program Saturday Night Live. But in prime time, CBS ruled.
Which was when the most number of eyeballs were focused on the screen.
Yeah, by an order of magnitude. This is when people are home watching TV, and this is when advertisers want to put the new cars and beers in front of dad.
Right.
And so that's the lucrative time for a TV network. And CBS did this on the strength of a wide variety of programs, you know, going all the way back to I Love Lucy, but then popular Westerns like Gunsmoke. And by the late 60s, they were still dominant. In 1967, 1968, CBS had 13 of the top 18 rated primetime shows. And in 1968, the entire top five is a CBS lineup. The biggest shows in America are Andy Griffith, Lucille Ball's new show, Gomer Pyle, Gunsmoke, Family Affair.
Boy, that really gives you a strange picture of the late 60s that being Generation X, we never quite see into. What year was that like? You're talking about 68, 69?
68. So you would think this is going to be counterculture, laughing and Smothers Brothers.
And it's seriously five shows where people are like, yuck, yuck.
It's Andy Griffith, Lucille Ball, it's Gunsmoke. It's stuff that could have been on 10 years before or 20 years before.
Hee-haw.
And it is Hee-haw. Hee-haw was a CBS show. And CBS started to get this reputation for having these weirdly kind of backwoods shows led by Andy Griffith and Jim Nabors.
Right.
And they were disparagingly called the country broadcasting system.
Wow.
And this is not something that, the funny thing is, this is just not a continuation of rural American culture. This had to be created. In 1957, there were a lot of Westerns on TV,
right,
which you could say is kind of a rural frontier.
My dad loved watching Westerns. My mom would say, you know, dad would come home and before I was born, turn on the TV and watch Gunsmoke or whatever Western was on. Loved them.
In old movies, they always watch Westerns because you can immediately tell, you know, you'll just hear bang, 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 an Indian war loops.
Yeah,
you know, wah, 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 wah. And, you know, the subtext is clear. We don't have to license any dialogue, but this guy's watching primetime TV,
right,
which is probably a Western. But the dawn of rural TV actually started in 1957 on ABC. Hmm. When they badly needed a hit, and these two Broadway writer producers, Norm and Irving Pincus, told them they had a surefire success. The Pincus brothers said, "We got this idea. Walter Brennan in a show called The Real McCoys, about kind of a West Virginia hillbilly family that comes west to California. They inherit a ranch in San Fernando Valley, and they move out to the valley and make pornography."
Did Up From the Ground come bubbling crude? I mean,
this is before the Beverly Hillbillies by 5 years. And
so the Beverly Hillbillies are kind of ripping off
this
concept? They're
rip off of The Real McCoys.
Oh, yeah.
So for 6 years on on ABC, The Real McCoys were a huge hit. And it's the same Beverly Hillbillies kind of fish out of water thing. You got Grandpappy Amos played by Walter Brennan, mm-hmm, you know, the cowboy sidekick from the 40s. Has like three Best Supporting Actor Oscars, I think. Very good opposite Humphrey Bogart into Have and Have Not. But he's kind of this grandpappy who's out of step in the modern world. But typically his conservative worldview is proved to be correct.
Of course.
Even in the San Fernando Valley of 1959. And, you know, there's a little bit of minstrelsy to it. I mean, this was not for rural people to finally see themselves. This was really for everybody in America to kind of laugh at these bumpkins.
Right. The bumpkins that have a heart of gold. And
that's
true for most of this stuff, right?
I thought you were going to say it was true for most bumpkins.
Most bumpkins have a heart of gold. But no, Gomer Pyle is never wrong, right? By the end of the episode, his simplicity turns out to be the only thing that we can count on.
The trappings are funny. You know, having a rock granny in a rocking chair on the back of a truck is funny.
Right.
And it's funny that they don't know how to use a telephone or whatever. But no, obviously their homespun ideals always went out in the end against the crooked developer or right, the snooty PTA lady or the
contemptibly articulate man with a pencil mustache.
Right. Yeah. There's an anti-bigotry episode of The Real McCoys, but it's bigotry against hillbillies. The local kids are calling the hillbilly kids slurs. So the other networks take notes of this huge hit. And in 1960, CBS rolls out its kind of appeal to that audience, the Andy Griffith Show. Mm-hmm. Andy Griffith plays kind of a widowed sheriff in a impossibly bucolic small American town of Mayberry.
Andy Griffith, though, is smart. Like, he's not portrayed as a dumb hillbilly. He's like
No, he's folksy.
Folksy, right.
And I guess Barney Fife, Don Knotts, is dumb. The town is full of... town has some clowns.
Yeah.
But yes, in general, he's another kind of simple but wise, salt-of-the-earth type. And that's not a fish out of water show. You know, Mayberry is all about building the world of this, you know, the kind of lost nostalgic America.
But don't they have like city folks that come through and they're and blow a tire or I mean they I think folks come into Mayberry that don't belong there.
I think so. And as you said, some of the later shows have the fish out of water conceit very prominently. Beverly Hillbillies, and then of course Green Acres, which has kind of a rich Park Avenue guy feeling the lure of the soil and moving his spoiled socialite wife
right
to Hooterville. But here's my question. This is like 1960, you know, America's changing. This is no longer the state Eisenhower era. This is young, vibrant Jack Kennedy's America. This is the new frontier. What, in your opinion, is the appeal of these throwback hayseed shows?
Well, isn't it always that that we pine for the simpler times of 20 years ago when we didn't have all these darned cell phones and whatnot? I mean, it seems like an eternal, if you read back like the diaries of Samuel Pepys,
is he like the 1530s were the best?
He's always talking about, you know, how relaxed it was before the court got all up in its bunches.
I think there's something to that because the early 60s would have been kind of the dawn of the man in the gray flannel suit where, you know, America, the average American man is now kind of a stressed, harried office type, right?
Well, and
who misses a simpler time.
After World War II, there was such a transformation of rural America. This was when all of a sudden you had electricity and telephones and sewers going into all these places that up until throughout the war, I guess, people in a lot of rural communities were still they weren't on a grid of any kind. So that electrification, the suburbanization, the urbanization, it all was happening in this 10-year period. And it must have been incredibly destabilizing for people who weren't already living on Madison Avenue.
It's tempting to think this is the time period when Americans moved to the cities. And of course, that's not true. You know, there was America, you know, when America was founded, 5% of the country was city dwellers. And today it's over 80%. But that inflection point where it passed 50% was around World War I.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Before 1920, half of all Americans were living in a city. And, you know, if you look at early TV, it is kind of a sparkling, urbane atmosphere. You know, right. It's erudite panel shows. It's, you know, the biggest sitcom hit is I Love Lucy, this woman with a Cuban bandleader husband and a nice New York penthouse who keeps meeting celebrities.
Yeah. But even the Honeymooners were blue-collar city dwellers.
Exactly. They're blue-collar, but they're probably Brooklyn or the Bronx.
Yeah, and all the like, the romantic comedies of that era too, they're all in penthouse apartments, right? They all
right, these beautiful Art Deco apartments.
Yeah. If you ever see someone out in a field, it's just that their car broke down.
So the subtext of TV really is these are educated people, these are urbanites. And the 60s boom in Petticoat Junction type shows, I don't know if it's something in the zeitgeist or if it's just, you know, chasing one hit. The Real McCoys was a hit, so let's do six ripoffs.
Well, but think about Gilligan's Island. Which
I would prefer not to.
No, I want you to. I want you to think about it. I want you to start with me at the very beginning.
Now I can't. A three-hour tour.
Yes, that's right.
Why do they have all those changes of clothes
the
then?
The skipper and Marianne, the millionaire and the professor.
You've never actually heard this song. if this was still the one, you would know every
Gilligan
word.
Gilligan and the rest. But Gilligan's Island and Green Acres came out about the same time. I think Gilligan's Island preceded it a little bit. Both had this millionaire and his wife who were put in this situation. I mean, Gilligan's Island is the ultimate. How do we recapture our essence in a world gone mad?
It's a fertile comic ground to take people and, you know, to do the Crocodile Dundee thing and put somebody in a weird environment.
Right.
You know, to this day, that the first Thor movie is entirely powered by, what if Thor tried to use an escalator? Is it going to be funny if he tries to order in a diner? I mean,
well, Munsters and Addams Family, same exact conceit, except in a different direction. Like they're
right. They're hillbillies, but like from the hills of Transylvania.
And they don't recognize that they're the weird ones.
Right. That's true. They think, you know, they think the neighbors are weird. That's the whole joke.
So you're absolutely right to look at all of this programming as kind of a piece. And is it a return, or is it a, it isn't just fish out of water comedy. There's something really nostalgic about it for people of the time. They're not, it's not just like, hey, we've got, because Dick Van Dyke is a great example of a 60s sitcom that is still erudite people in a cool apartment.
He's a showbiz cool insider. House. He writes for a comedy show. Could not be more insider meta.
They're like mid-century modern.
Goes out cool to his house. Nice suburban mid-century modern house. Yeah. Mary Tyler Moore in capri pants.
So it wasn't universal, but wow, what a preponderance of these shows.
And it just suddenly starts in 1960, the time when you would think the rural influence on American culture would be ending.
Right.
Instead, it takes over the airwaves. And CBS is still the number one show in America in 1970 when number one network in America, yes, when a young executive named Fred Silverman takes over.
I've heard of him.
Programming. And Fred Silverman decides, we are tired of being laughingstocks. We are not the country broadcasting system.
Even though they're the top rated.
Even though these shows are still, okay, there have been some decline. Green Acres ratings are down. Beverly Hillbillies ratings are down. These shows are past their prime. Jim Nabors wants to leave Gomer Pyle to do the singing or whatever else he does. B. Benaderet wants to leave Petticoat Junction. You may remember her as the voice of Granny in Looney Tunes cartoons. Yeah. She was also the lead on Green Acres. So some of the shows are kind of winding down. But Fred Silverman, in the space of 1 or 2 years, institutes what's called the Rural Purge. It's not called that at the time.
Right.
But in hindsight, when we can see the network reshaping itself, you can see that he cancels anything old-timey on the network in the space of 2 seasons.
So we think of Fred Silverman, at least I do, as somebody from the 80s.
Right. Is he the ABC guy?
Yeah, 80s? Who's like an older dude by then. But in 1960 or 1970, he's like,
Young Turk.
He's like 30, right?
Yeah. And so the old-timey shows go away. It's all these kind of hayseedy country shows, but it's also, you know, kind of stale-seeming variety shows, you know, Red Skelton Hour and other vaudevillian shows. Uh-huh. The Westerns, you know, that was the action paradigm for a generation of kids, was cowboys and Indians. But, you know, the Westerns go away as well. And some of these were still successful shows. CBS is still the number one show. Mayberry RFD, the kind of the successor to... The Andy Griffith-less successor to The Andy Griffith Show is a top 20 show. Hee Haw, a new Nashville Grand Ole Opry comedy show, is in the top 20. Fred doesn't care. It's all got to go, and he cleans house.
Well, so now he eliminated Hee Haw, but Hee Haw continued as a viable syndicated show for 2 decades.
Well, these properties were still popular. So for the first time you had, you know, extremely popular shows that were homeless. First run syndication was kind of invented here. I mean, there had been kind of oddball hits in first run syndication, you know, game shows and the like. But this was the first time that shows that had big primetime audience could say, you know, could approach local affiliates directly and say, hey, if we can get 100 of you to buy our show, we can stay a going concern. So Lassie is canceled, but Lassie goes into syndication for a couple of years. Lawrence Welk is canceled because what could be older than a... You know, kind of a German guy from the Midwest conducting polkas.
But he continued until 2016.
Yeah, he's still alive. No, Lawrence Welk goes on for 11 seasons. I used to love Lawrence Welk as a kid when I was 3 or 4 years old.
Not a surprise, as much as you might think.
Can you see that a little bit?
A little bit. And a one and a two.
Hee Haw's the big success story. After it's canceled after a mere couple seasons on CBS, it runs for 20 years in syndication. Does not go off the air till 1992.
Wow.
Like Bill Clinton is running for president when Hee Haw is canceled. And I guess they were like, we did it.
I watched Hee Haw and I don't know how. I'm not exactly sure what
you know how?
Well, no, because my mom is from Northern Ohio, and there, I don't think, is any worse prejudice in America than the people of than what the people of Northern Ohio feel for the people of Southern Ohio.
She needs to watch that anti-bigotry episode of The Real McCoy.
She does.
I think, to stop using offensive words like yokel.
She does. She feels like the West Virginia and Kentucky are some kind of like foreign land. And so she was really against like the music of John Denver, for instance, like any kind of American fetishization. How would you say it? Fetishization?
Making it fetid? Fetishization.
Fetishization.
Right? Like creating a fetish out of
right.
country.
Any kind of American fetishization of rural country people.
Yeah.
My mom was like, drew a hard line against it in our house.
Because in her eyes, they are trash and should not be... She romanticized?
She wouldn't use the word trash, but she feels like as a Northerner, she felt like culture was something that the Dick Van Dyke Show was the world she aspired to and was the world that she thought was sort of morally superior.
She doesn't think John Denver has an ottoman?
She does not think that country roads are anything to celebrate. She thinks that city streets are better than country roads. She was extremely suspicious of that world because I think growing up in a post-Civil War Ohio, like her grandfather fought in the Civil War for the Union.
So they were still pretty stark dividing lines.
Stark dividing line, because Ohio was the one place in the country where it was the Union was only one state deep, really. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the choke point. And the area around Cincinnati, she still felt like...
A little suspect.
Certainly southeastern Ohio, she considered was part of West Virginia and wouldn't go down there.
I mean, if you've been to Southern Ohio, it is part of Kentucky and West Virginia. Yeah. I mean, culturally, it is. You should not expect a Rust Belt vibe.
But what I'm wondering is how the hell I ever saw Hee Haw, because if she'd come in the room or if she'd heard it from the kitchen, she would have been like, turn off that hillbilly music.
Were you sneaking to friends' houses to watch Hee Haw?
Maybe it was a thing after I moved up to Alaska in the 70s to live with my dad. Maybe he didn't monitor my Hee Haw consumption.
Well, it was on at weird times because it was syndicated.
Right.
So, you know, in the middle of the afternoon or, you know, 9 o'clock at night, suddenly Hee Haw might be on some weird, you know, channel 14. And I watched a ton of Hee Haw because it plays really well with young boys. There's all these like corny comedy eggs, like literally corny in a cornfield.
Yeah, right.
And there's also all these kind of winsome Southern beauties with their shirts tied under their chests and, you know, skimpy overalls.
There's a lot of people slipping on banana peels. I mean, when I played the Grand Ole Opry, which the Long Winters. Oh, I'm sorry, not Grand Ole Opry.
Did I drop this?
when the Long Winters played the Ryman Auditorium mm-hmm. in Nashville, there's a bronze statue of Minnie Pearl in the lobby of the Ryman. And we walked in, and I stopped with her and like,
howdy.
I said, why, Minnie Pearl?
That was a lot of the appeal of Hee Haw to me, is it opened up this whole other world that had its own set of celebrities.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Minnie Pearl apparently is some kind of country singer, but
Roy Clark, Buck Owens.
I mean, Buck Owens, you know, a genuine talent of Bakersfield country, changed the face of music, but I didn't know that at the time. I just thought of them as kind of vaudevillians. But all these kind of odd celebrities, like Minnie Pearl just has price tags on her hat, and she and Grandpa Jones are going to bicker about that. And there's one guy that maybe he's a country singer, but mostly he's just, they're making fat jokes about him.
Yeah.
And this lady must be a country singer, but her teeth are blacked out. It was the same reason why I got into wrestling. Like, there's all these, you got to figure out all these relationships. And this guy used to be a bad guy, but now he's not. Or this guy used to have a jail gimmick, but now he's, you know, now he's born again, or what's going on here?
I had this exact same experience with that show. I remember trying to decode it and being fascinated by it. But it was, at least when we were consuming it, it was kind of hand in hand with that late 70s, early 80s rural revival that we've talked about before in trucker culture.
Right.
That was the Smokey era. And the Bandit and Urban Cowboy.
It's true. You can't keep it down. You can try to purge the rural. You can take the country out of the, you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy.
Yeah. You can take the hick shows off of CBS, but they're just going to migrate over to.
To Burt Reynolds movies. Right. I guess you can take the country out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the country. That's the way to say it.
You just said it.
There's also kind of a racial element here. I mean, if you think about it, you know, the under you know, the subtext of all television for the first 20 years of American TV is this is for middle-class white people.
Right.
You know, watch this.
There are very few black people in any of these shows that you've mentioned.
Right. No, there's hardly even...
Except,
you know,
Red Fox.
There's barely immigrants or, you know, Italian. It would be novel if there was an Italian character. Or,
well, you know, the Dean Martin show was playing over on late night TV somewhere.
He's the safe edge of the... He's the knife's edge of Italian immigration.
But integration was happening on TV, like, slowly and in fits and starts, right? Carson was really good about having everybody on his show. And you had Bill Cosby.
But it was big news. Yeah. I mean, there were above the line names who could do it. But it was big news when Captain Kirk had a black lady answering his phone calls. Like, look how daring this is. We put an Asian and an African-American lady.
And a Scot.
Like all three kinds of people that there are. And even that show had to have a good old Southern doctor.
Oh, well, and you remember the groundbreaking kiss between Uhuru and Kirk.
Right.
Was like, I think, the first interracial kiss on TV.
I think it's often called that. Yeah. And of course they've been mind controlled. They don't want to kiss.
Right.
So that's their cover.
Oh,
but,
no.
But, you know, when you think about it, that, you know, this idea that, this in the 60s, as you know, black consciousness and black power is on the rise, and civil rights era, all this stuff is on the rise. CBS is going back to these kind of lily white Appalachian right. towns. It's not a good look, right? And
Fred Silverman is hip to this,
right? And if you know, he's got kind of a liberal sounding name. Guy might have been a freedom writer.
A liberal sounding name.
Does it begin with a chemical element?
Oh, that's nice.
And if you've listened to Gil Scott Heron's kind of spoken word, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised piece, he actually name checks CBS Rural TV twice as kind of something he sees as a problem. He says, Green Acres, the Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damned relevant because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. He says the theme song will not be written by Jimmy Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash. Glenn Campbell and Johnny Cash were two kind of country types who had these very popular variety shows where they were trying to appeal to a broader audience.
Johnny Cash was trying to appeal to the speed addicted cross country truck driver.
It is funny to watch him back then. You know he's facing personal demons, but on TV he's just. You know, he's trying to be your cuddly CBS grandpa.
Tom Jones is a pretty complex character. I mean, he's Welsh.
Yeah, Tom Jones is Welsh. He doesn't fit into that country listing.
Right.
But you know, among the names that yeah. Gil is name checking are this kind of country fried vibe.
Gil
Scott Heron, primetime TV.
It should be remembered, was also against the moon landing.
Well, look, if you could cancel Beverly Hillbillies, wouldn't you cancel the moon landing? Like, it's kind of a wash. The main reason all this happened, though, was not social or even socioeconomic. It was straight up economic. Advertisers were starting to care less about the overall number of people watching a show.
Oh, and who was watching the
show? Exactly. This is the birth of the coveted, whatever it is, 19 to 35 demographic.
Interesting.
This was the dawn of, you know, the man in the gray flannel suit crunching numbers. And they realized, wait a second, we can find out if affluent people are watching this show and therefore buying the cars and the dishwashers.
I'm sure it was Madison Avenue that invented the concept.
It's Madison Avenue all the way. This is a Don Draper era thing. And suddenly it didn't matter if 30 million people are watching Mayberry RFD if it's not the right people.
Right.
If it's old people, if it's, you know, people from flyover states, they can start to see this data now.
Well, it depends. I mean, if you're trying to sell Winston's or Chesterfield's, that's who you want. But if you want to sell washing machines or a brand new Buick, yeah, you want to cut the fat out.
Cut the corn pone out.
Get the corn pone out.
Get the bacon lard out.
Get all of them bacon lards. Out.
So Fred Silverman is smelling the future here. He sees which way...
It smells like jet fuel.
He sees which way the wind is blowing. And even though these shows are number one shows now, like his network's going to be left in the dust if they are still kind of chasing this old rural dollar.
See, that's the kind of bold leadership that media companies... media companies tend to be chasing fads. It's rare when you see a visionary who, even when they're on top, can pivot
away from old people.
Yeah,
Because one thing that happened is this kind of created for the first time this cult of youth in American TV. And previously, families watched all these shows together. They were designed for that. But suddenly, you know, Fred Silverman, after canceling all these shows, has all these empty spaces in his program, and he replaces them with these CBS forward-thinking shows for boomers that we were talking about earlier, All in the Family and all its kind of socially aware spinoffs, Mary Tyler Moore, you know, Single Lady in the Big City and all those spinoffs.
Right, Rhoda.
The variety shows, the Red Skelton variety shows get replaced with Sonny and Cher or Flip Wilson. So it's a more diverse, counterculture-friendly vibe.
But there was some holdover in the form of like the Waltons, but it was much more...
That's interesting.
It wasn't as like Herc Dirk. It was much more...
So Fred Silverman is the one who brings the Waltons to CBS after the Rural Purge. And it does kind of stand out in the schedule. Maybe he's counter-programming Little House on the Prairie, which is a big hit on NBC. Or it's probably the other way around, actually. I bet Little House came after the Waltons. But you're right. The Waltons, the premise
is...
It's a
little darker. I mean, it's more of a drama.
It's the depression. Right. Mom has tuberculosis. It's not an idealized rural America. It's like, it's more of a, this was my, you know, Earl Hamner's childhood. You know, the guy who created the show is John Boy.
Right.
And so it's kind of him remembering from a modern perspective what these times were really like.
Right, super sort of hard scrabble. I mean, I remember the Waltons and Little House on the Prairie kind of being, those shows didn't appeal to me as a kid. They felt a little bit too, there was too much.
Gingham.
There was a lot of gingham, but it was too dramatic. I didn't want,
the dog dies.
Yeah.
Those are shows where the dog might die.
I didn't want where the red fern grows. I wanted to, you know, to be on a boat full of love.
And when it comes to action shows, you know, he replaces Dad's Westerns with kind of a new, grittier set of shows set in cities. You know, you get Kojak instead of Gunsmoke, and you get all these Quinn Martin shows like Cannon. And honestly, it kind of leads to all our modern shows where there's a flawed, you know, a Dr. House or whatever, kind of an eccentric in the middle of a procedural, you know, solving tonight's crime or tragedy or whatever it is.
And that, yeah, so that became a whole genre, the Starsky and Hutch, the Rockford Files. I mean, they were all...
Hardly any police shows before this time, which is weird.
Yeah, you had the police procedurals were much more like detectives.
Yeah, it's Perry Mason.
Yeah,
yeah,
but exactly. These are all like cool dudes in leather jackets who are doing undercover, like, vice work.
In not just a city, but not a nice part of the city.
Right.
You know, it's very far from Dodge City.
Although this would have been a time when American anxiety was focused on the unrest, the urban unrest that was also kind of a new phenomenon in this decade.
Right.
So let's send Kojak in there.
He'll figure it out.
Baby.
Who loves you, baby? So you kind of create a separate track of media. You know, the old people can still watch their Hee-Haw and their Wild Kingdom on syndicated TV, but they've effectively been marginalized. This is the moment when American culture passes them by and says, flip through all three channels. None of this stuff is for you anymore. Look, there's like young people and black people. There's rock music. Like,
right.
Like this is not for you. And so maybe this is the beginning of kind of the creation of a ghetto for old people in the media, which eventually gives us the ability to create Limbaugh and Fox News for them, because they've been told the mainstream programming is not for you.
It's really interesting that the old people of Rush Limbaugh, of course, would have been...
They were the boomers.
The young people of... But
it might have been their parents, but...
I think when All in the Family came on, again, talking to my mom, she was in computers at the time, and a lot of her coworkers were the pressed white short-sleeve shirt and pocket protector types that put a man on the moon.
Yeah.
But they weren't very progressive. And she said she carpooled to work because that was the style at the time. And the other three guys in her carpool would sit and recap the previous night's All in the Family episode, unaware that Archie Bunker was the villain, was the cad.
That we're like, supposed to be laughing at
him. They admired him as he told off those hippies and those...
And then words you can't say.
And she just sat and kept, you know, just like, head down. These were guys she worked with. They were her friends. But when they started talking about All in the Family, she couldn't even venture the idea that Archie Bunker was a you know, was a sarcastic character, or was, you know, you were not meant to see him as the hero of the show.
That's funny that these are not refrigerator repairmen or whatever, that these are educated.
But computer people, so educated.
Well, I mean, we see the same thing today where, you know, computer people are turned into libertarians the second that their stock options are on the line or whatever. Their progressivism is a millimeter thick.
But it's easy to see, it could conceivably be easy to identify with Archie Bunker, but the spinoffs from that show were Maude, The Jeffersons, Good Times.
Right.
I mean, none of those shows are you going to go into.
There's no window character there. Maude's getting an abortion. George Jefferson is railing against the honkies and the crackers.
Although George Jefferson was a sort of clownish figure, but there weren't any white heroes in that show.
Not at all. And this alienation also potentially leads to kind of an East-West divide in America.
Some people had peachy folders and some didn't.
Exactly, the Hardy-Carell Jr. line. It's really interesting if you look at electoral maps from the area following the rural purge. In the West, you know, today we think of the Pacific states as kind of this reliable progressive bulwark. But between 1960, when Nevada went for Nixon, I guess in 1968, Washington went for Humphrey. And in 1988, Washington, Oregon went for Dukakis. Between those 2 years, there is not a state west of Texas that votes for a Democrat.
Whoa.
Isn't that weird?
Wow.
Even like when you look at the Ford-Carter election, it's pretty much like a straight line down America. Like everything to the left of the line is red. Everything to the right of the line is blue. And I kind of wonder if canceling all the Westerns and kind of telling the frontier, hey, the frontier, as people insist I say.
Frontier, I would say, yes.
People telling the frontier, hey,
But you know, your people are from the frontier, so you can call it whatever you want.
The dictionary says frontier is fine. I'm tired of having this discussion with well-meaning idiots. But this is the moment when the West kind of gets fed up with the Eastern elites, telling them, you know, not only are we telling you where your herds can graze,
right?
We're also not going to let you watch Bonanza anymore. Like, you don't get to see yourselves on TV. It's now all Eastern elites again.
And this is the era of the rise of Ronald Reagan, probably from that same thing.
Exactly. Ronald Reagan gets up on stage and says, I'm part of the Sagebrush Rebellion, you guys. Like, I'm one of you. You know, the prominent Republicans of this era, Nixon and Reagan, were Californians, right, who could plausibly say, we're the future of America, not these old-timey Southern Democrats. You know,
right.
like look to the future with us, Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, the men of tomorrow.
Because these were the beginnings of the water wars, the Bureau of Land Management. Right. I mean,
most of it comes down to that stuff, and not Gunsmoke getting canceled.
It's weird that they would posit themselves as the modern, vital, and virile future, but also have that connected to this sort of Western cowboy revisionism.
It's sleight of hand for sure. Like, you know, they saw how Kennedy got elected and thought, well, we got to do that, even if it doesn't match the platform much.
Yeah, sure. Because yeah, the Southern Democrats had really shown their hand throughout the 60s.
Civil rights era.
Yeah, they were hard to admire. And there wasn't yet that urban Democrat coalition. It hadn't become I was about to say the unstoppable force that it is now, but it still seems like it's fairly stoppable.
So I don't know. I can't really say that, you know, Petticoat Junction getting canceled led to the Reagan Revolution and Fox News, you know, the invention of the modern kind of ghettoized media blinders. But I'm not saying it. And it all started because, you know, Fred Silverman did not want to be the network of the past. Pat Buttram, who played Mr. Haney on Green Acres, famously, you know, lost his job from this and famously said the 1971 was the year that CBS killed everything with a tree in it, including Lassie.
The presence of the Southern United States as a cultural force, as a rebellious force, is something that we see over and over and we try to account for it somehow. But of course, the South has a population of 120-something million people.
Wow. If you give them Texas and Florida, right?
If you give them Texas and Florida. And so it's a full third of the population of the country.
More than a third, yeah.
And so the idea of the South, Americans are fixated on it, maybe even beyond its it's certainly beyond its geographical and population significance within the country. We think about the South all the time because of our relationship with it is so troubled. And, you know, the South has Texas and Florida, but you could also say that these days it has Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma.
Sure.
Or, I mean, it always had Oklahoma.
It's maybe losing Virginia, North Carolina, but it's creeping up into Iowa, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So I think every time there's a rural purge one place, you get a rural splurge somewhere else. And that concludes the Rural Purge, entry 1091.PS6503, certificate number 36841 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. You can see Ken and me fetishizing the South.
That's what we always do.
On our social media, at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick.
I fetishize Southern food and possibly Hee-Haw supporting players.
You know, in my family, my mom has this deep, deep Northernism, but my father's family are from Kentucky.
That's my dad's family as well.
Yeah, so...
So we grew up eating collard, you know, messy greens, and, you know, I love, you know, Southern food is very deep in me.
Southern food didn't make it all the way to me, and my dad was a ardent 50s liberal Democrat, but he was doing that in like, angry response to his parents, or to his mother and her family, who were just as Southern as could be.
Then how come it didn't bounce back? How come you didn't rebel against your dad?
I play the banjo. Like,
you love NASCAR. Everyone says so.
No, it's funny. The migration out here to the Northwest, my dad really embraced unions and organized, you know, not just organized labor, but the organized labor principle of liberal politics out here. And there was no other air in the room when I was growing up. It wasn't like you could have a different theory.
It's also not a great city for soul food.
Seattle?
Yes. To this day, where would you go for Southern cooking in Seattle? It's a little
thin. There are places they pop up, right, and say like, Southern cooking over here, and then they all go out of business. But we do definitely, Ken and I like to go to barbecue restaurants and take pictures of cornbread, so follow us on Twitter and Instagram. You can also go to our Facebook page, which is the Omnibus Futurelings. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, and you can mail us all of your homespun recipes.
Yeah, don't send the cornbread.
Don't send the cornbread.
Just send your cornbread recipe.
Don't send any jars of your grandma's special sauce, because we're contractually obligated to throw it away. But anything else, your dad's, your great-granddad's Civil War medals, you can send to P.O. Box 55744 Shoreline, Washington 98155.
Listeners, from our vantage point here in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization will survive. Perhaps a rural / urban purge is coming. We hope and pray that this catastrophe may never come, but if the incident comes soon, whatever it is, the capital I incident, then this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word to you. But if Providence allows, we hope to be spared. We hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.